Well, our first two panellists have set a very high standard, so a bit of a challenge for my session. Good morning and welcome. Yes, I have been enjoying a short sabbatical for the last little while, which I must say, if you ever get the opportunity, it's my first opportunity that I've taken, I thoroughly recommend it. I'm getting re-engaged in the industry. One of the roles I've got involved in is on the board of SPA, which is the Self-Managed Super Funds Professionals Association. But having said that, I will say that the comments I have this morning are very much my personal views on a wide range of advice issues rather than necessarily representing SPA views. Now, first of all, don't you love the title, The Hard Sell? So and I know there's a degree of poetic license used in these programs. I must say, you know, just starting on a slightly provocative note, I had some issue with the title because it may reinforce some of the common perceptions or misperceptions about the advice industry. Because my contention actually is that in the main, advice is extremely valuable. In the main, it's delivered very well. And so I'm actually a great believer in the value of advice, and I'll expand on that somewhat in a moment. Before getting onto some key themes and messages, there is one overriding issue which is impacting the whole of the industry. Right across the financial services industry, all segments, all super fund types, all advice segments, and that is the current lack of investor confidence. It's collapsing return expectations. If you look at some of the surveys, people's expectations of returns in both the short term and medium term are collapsing. That's driving a shift in investor and consumer behaviour towards much more defensive type investment behaviour and low risk investments. And even in growth investments, they're shifting to growth investments which are much more income-orientated than capital growth-orientated. I actually think it's a major issue for the industry because it's not necessarily healthy or rational behaviour, and part of the role of advice is to coach people in the right direction. Now, key themes and messages. In most presentations, it's recommended that you just cover three key points. Martin Mulcair would tell me that, just cover three key points. But I figure an actuarial audience has got at least double the capacity. So I'll cover six key points. And I could cover a lot more. I'll touch on those in a moment. But what's more, in the context of the big picture, I thought I'd add some extra interest. So as I go through the presentation, I do indeed have some big pictures. And there'll be a little quiz at the end on a system to see how you go on that. I will flag in advance there's a bit of a New South Wales, North Coast bias in the pictures. Key themes. First one, confidence in advice. My contention is advice is actually really valuable, but confidence in advice has taken a bit of a hit, and there needs to be a collective effort across the industry, across the various types, to restore and build confidence in advice. Secondly, the regulatory reform and industry dynamics. A lot of the focus with the FOFA reforms in particular has been on the advice end of the spectrum and the licensee end of the spectrum. But I would argue that the changes are just as profound right across the value chain, including at the funds management end, and I'll expand on that. Scaled advice, incredibly important if we're going to increase access to advice. But there's some issues there, including the fact that there's an unlevel playing field. Middle Australia. Paul and Debbie's comments in particular are addressing, I think, Middle Australia in terms of some of the advice models they run. I do have some concerns that there's a risk there that Middle Australia is going to get disenfranchised from advice. And we'll talk through some issues on that front. Growth on self-managed super funds, really strong growth. There's some interesting changes in demographics occurring there. We'll run through that. And post-retirement. Post-retirement really is the next big frontier. And my contention here is that there's a need for much greater sophistication and innovation in the post-retirement sector on both the product side and the advice side than we are currently seeing. So, confidence in advice. We'll start with the big banana. So the quiz is you've got to work out the locations of these ones. So we'll start with an easy one. So pardon the resolution here. As I say, advice is valuable, but confidence in advice and the financial services sector has slipped. Now, in terms of supporting the contention that advice is available, if you look at the AFA core data research, it was conducted in about March 2010, about 2,500 participants, both people who receive advice and those who don't. And what they found is that consumers who are advised plan better, are happier with their investments, are wealthier, are more engaged with their finances, have greater certainty and control, and a whole range of really positive attributes. The research covered the main key roles of advisors: strategic, tactical, which read product, and, if you like, implementation, project management. They're the three key roles of a good advisor. It found that financial advisors are indeed highly trusted by those clients who are advised, and in fact they rated amongst professionals as the third highest. After all, I might add, this was interesting, specialist doctors and dentists. So those who receive advice actually have got a really high opinion of it. You see a lot of surveys which might give you a different impression, that advice isn't highly regarded. Why is that? Most surveys are made up of a mix, 25% of those who receive advice, 75% who don't. So the perceptions given by those who don't receive advice is based on what they read in the media, some of the issues they've seen in the industry. That's what shapes their impression. The 25% who actually receive advice have actually got a really good regard for it. So bear that in mind next time you read some survey results. There was research done by the FSC Econtech. In summary, those who receive advice, a 30-year-old would save an extra $91,000, a 45-year-old would save an extra $80,000, a 60-year-old would save an extra $29,000 if they received advice. So there's no doubt that advice is valuable and value-adding. We do face the issue, however, that there has been reputation damage in the last couple of years. Some of the issues in the industry, the regulatory reform process, the amount of media coverage that's attracted, add on the GFC, poor returns, volatile capital markets, all of that has led to a bit of a issue of confidence in the industry and confidence in advice. And we've got a collective responsibility to rebuild that trust and confidence. One manifestation of that reducing confidence in the funds management sector is the behaviour that you see with significant funds under advice and clients shifting to the self-managed super fund sector, where people believe that they can do a better job. Now, you might debate that, but that's what drives some of that behaviour. We still do have issues to cover. If you read through some of the ASIC shadow shopping latest research, there are still issues we need to address in this industry. One of those is an overemphasis on product versus strategising and advice. Another one is the failure to provide sufficient justification for switching activity in super. There are a range of issues to address. We need to tackle those, we need to raise professional standards, we need to raise education, and most importantly, we need a stronger professional governance framework. My contention is every advisor, every planner, it should be mandated that they are a member of a professional planning body, which has got a code, it's got standards, and importantly, it's got a disciplinary scheme, like our profession. And if you get pinged by the professional body, you can't operate. That would be the most powerful thing to raise standards in the industry. Okay, regulatory reform. A whole bunch of issues here. Some of these you've heard many times before, so I won't cover it in detail. Opt-in has largely been addressed now. Opt-in is superficially attractive, but there are actually lots of unintended and some potentially adverse consequences. It's likely to increase the cost of advice. It's likely to accelerate the shift of advisors only looking after the top end of the market rather than middle Australia as well. It could lead to people inadvertently falling outside of advice and PI coverage and a range of issues. So superficially it sounds attractive. I think a pragmatic outcome has been worked out in the regulatory process. The one thing which didn't get addressed is the issue about payments. Paul was referring to some of the commercial models before, payments between platform providers and licensees. Now, quite frankly, they fall into two categories. There are those which conflict or have the potential to conflict advice and they should be prohibited. And there's also those which don't conflict advice at all and none of the margin goes through to advisors and it doesn't influence advisor recommendations at all. But the way in which it's been implemented is both types, the good and the bad, have been impacted by the reform process. The effect of that is that the changes then favour vertically integrated players because they can choose where they realise margin in the value chain. Is it at the advice licensee level, the platform layer, or the funds management layer? So the changes favour vertically integrated. It will lead to consolidation. It's already happening. in terms of the independent sector, it's the three largest higher quality type operators which have already been subject to consolidation. So Count acquired by CBA, Lonsdale by IOOF, and you've seen the Shadforth Snowball merger. So in the short term, we're going to see more consolidation occurring, but just as the tide ebbs and flows, my prediction is that we'll actually see a resurgent IFA sector in due course, and that the big driver of that actually will be accountants once the accountant licensing regime comes into play. The best interest impacts are profound. This is probably one of the most important areas of the FOBA reforms. It doesn't attract a huge amount of coverage, and again, people focus on what's the impact at the advice end of the spectrum. But it's just as profound for fund managers. If an advisor is constructing advice and a set of recommendations to meet client objectives, and amongst other things, they're trying to keep the cost for the client down to a reasonable level, but also make sure that their advisor margin is preserved, what you'll see is a big shift, in my view, to core and satellite strategies. And in the core, people will choose to access cheap beta through things like ETFs and passive funds and things like that, and they'll use active fund overlays to access alpha. Now, if that occurs, that's going to be a really big shift, and in particular will impact active fund managers. What else have we got there? I won't spend a lot of time on this one, but there is a big shift already occurring in terms of, if you like, ad valorem advice, in other words, charging as a percentage of FUA or commissions and brokerage to dollar retainer. Now, that's already occurring. For example, almost half the advice in the SMSF sector is now dollar retainer based. So there's already a big shift occurring. There's the potential that that actually might get mandated in the accounting sector because there's a draft standard there which actually might mandate that shift. The issue is, if that happens, it's probably going to further accelerate the migration of advisors to top-end clients, because with top-end clients, we will have the greatest propensity to actually pay dollar retainers, and that might actually exacerbate the issue in terms of middle Australia. Scaled and scoped advice. So onto the big pineapple. So scaled and scoped advice is incredibly important. It's incredibly important if there's to be expansion in the provision of financial advice rather than just redefining the rules for those who currently receive it. It's incredibly important, as we heard from Debbie and Paul, if middle Australia is not to be disenfranchised from advice propositions. And it's incredibly important if one of the stated goals of the FOFA reforms was increased access to financial advice. It would be a huge wasted opportunity in the whole FOFA reform process if we don't get some sensible outcomes in the area of scaled or scalable advice. And the question does arise that at the moment, is the retail sector and the SMSF sector getting the raw end of the pineapple? Super funds are advantaged in this area. They enjoy ASIC class order exemption 09210, for those who want to read the exciting stuff like that, which provides super fund trustees with relief from compliance with Section 945 suitability requirements in certain defined circumstances. Intra-fund advice and limited advice through some of these funds is often provided free, in inverted commas. Now, we know nothing's free. Effectively, it's been paid for by the broader membership. So it's factored into the core product administration pricing, which is paid for by members. So one could argue about the transparency of those arrangements. Now, the best interest obligation, when it came through in the legislation, was intended to address the issue of scaled advice. But at this stage, you'd have to say it's somewhat unsatisfactory. There's a lot of detail on best interest in Section 961B, going through all the best interest obligations, all of which sounds pretty reasonable until you get to 961B subparagraph G, which has a catch-all phrase which says that you need to look at clients, all clients' circumstances in the final construction of advice. Now, licensees, I'm going to take the risk. So there may be some extra guidance coming through from ASIC in due course, which will be really important. But even when that happens, none of that does address the current uneven playing field in respect of super funds being able to effectively bundle the cost or pricing of advice into their pricing of their underlying administration platform, whereas it's different in the retail SMSF sector. Okay, on to Middle Australia. This one might be a bit more challenging. We've got the big koala. So the original FOVA design principle, as I say, is to increase access to advice. However, it is the case already that advisors are already migrating. So this isn't a prediction. Advisors are already migrating to high-value client segments. If you're going to split it up into deciles, the top 2 to 3 deciles, advisors are already migrating that direction. The possible shift from asset-based fees to dollar retainers will only increase that further. And the big issue which arises is whether Middle Australia will be disenfranchised from advice. Now, that's going to depend on a range of things. It's going to depend very much on the outworking of this scaled advice regime. I agree absolutely with the comments made by Paul and Debbie in this area. We need to get the right outcome. I think a lot of advice will be and should be, actually, what I call serial scaled advice. In other words, a series, like you were saying, Debbie, of single-issue advice provided over a period of time. That would be a good outcome. It would address a lot of client needs. But we need the supporting legislative framework and the ASIC guidelines. It also depends on whether Middle Australia is disenfranchised or not, on whether the bank advice delivery model and the super funds are able to respond to the challenge in that space. Right, a couple of minutes, Barry, and I'll be done. Self-managed super funds, responding to needs and wants. So we've got the big merino here. So the context, if Australia was once riding on the back, sheep's back, well, now the super fund area arguably is with self-managed super funds. Big drivers here, you can see there, dissatisfaction with returns, control, something which is a bit more tactile, which people can touch, tax advantages, etc. It's still being formed at roughly the same rate, roughly 7,500 a quarter. Interestingly, the demographic is shifting. About 25% of people under age 45 now are forming self-managed super funds in respect of new SMSF formation. The other big shift occurring here, of course, is that there's the demographics of the self-managed super fund sector means that there's a large portion of those now moving into the post-retirement stage. So if the phenomenon of the growth in the self-managed super fund sector in the last decade has been growth in the accumulation stage, it's going to be the big driver in terms of growth in the post stage, and will account for actually about 40% of post-retirement fund flows. Big issue in the self-managed super fund sector are accountants. They are the gateway, and with the licensing requirements, they'll actually get a lot more involved than is currently the case, and as I say, I think that will start driving a resurgent IFA sector. Final comment, post-retirement, I'll do this very briefly because there have been other sessions on this. This is the next frontier, but this is the area where there's a need for much greater innovation. We all know the demographics and what's driving it. In my view, the current debate is way too skewed to product. Now, we're hearing all this debate about annuities and deferred annuities and appropriate asset allocations and growth, defence and the like. All of that's important. But the starting point for all of this should be what constitutes good advice. What's the strategising? If you get clients to force rank their goals between income, capital, estate, liquidity, and their tolerance for risk, they should be the drivers. And then you start designing solutions around that. No one product will meet all those needs. It's going to be how you combine together products to meet those income, capital, and liquidity goals. So it needs to be strategy and advice driven. Product second. So my contention in the post-retirement space is need for much greater sophistication, including modelling, need for much greater innovation in both the product area and the advice area, and to shift the focus to strategy and advice. All of that, I think, is a clarion call to actuaries to get more involved in that space. So summary, if I got it here. Well, lost my spot. The summary is advice is valuable. The regulatory changes have impacts across the value chain. We still have issues to sort out in terms of scaled advice. That is really important. And in the post-retirement sector, as I say, there needs to be a much greater shift towards strategising and advice than product. So, the quiz. See how you went with the quiz. On the way through, first one, big banana. Cassava, good. Next one was a bit more challenging, the big axe. Pretty close, yeah. Q, Warhope, take Warhope. Okay. Big pineapple. Nambour, yeah, very good. Big koala. Sorry? Is that near stall? Good, yeah. So that's an even more precise response than I had. The big merino. Goblin. Okay. And the world's biggest bowling ball, which was my representation of the retirees. That's a challenge. Hmm? Spot on. Yeah, well done. So who got 6 out of 6? A couple over here. Well done. Our award winners. Okay. Over to you, Barry.
Thanks, Andrew. Three more great presentations. I'll ask a question of you first, Paul. This is a whole question around independence. So the question is, how can bank-owned distribution claim to be independent when they have explicit targets on their parents, companies, products, and the vast majority of sales? So you can speak on behalf of all organisations.
Oh, no pressure. Great question. Well, the first thing I would say is, on behalf of all the major banks, the ones that I know...
And life companies.
They've actually moved away from KPIs for sales towards KPIs for revenues and essentially fees. So I can certainly say in the case of ANZ, that's the case. I know CBA's moved that way as well. I'm pretty sure they all have. So the advice model now is a advice model designed first and foremost based on client needs, followed up by execution through implementing product, yes, but the KPI models are fee and revenue based. Now, in terms of the issue of independence, clearly a bank is, all the banks have their own product sets, insurance product sets. In the case of ANZ, we don't actually have our own asset management. We certainly have platform and insurance. So I don't think there's any great surprises that, when you look at approved product lists, you've got, if in our case, you've got a OnePath offering. But on the insurance front, you've got quite a wide array of offerings. The reason for that is we fundamentally have a view that a platform is an administration vehicle that offers a supermarket of asset managers. And in our case, the asset managers are all external asset managers. And with insurance, there's a different world. Insurance products are more like the old retail world in that individual insurers offer individual contracts that have differences. So we have a wider range. In fact, we have five major insurance companies on our approved product list. So I think the old days of assuming that, bank-based advice is all about selling widgets and KPIing planners accordingly and having just your own asset management products and your own insurance products, those days are over. And all of the banks have pretty much gone down that track. And I think what you'll find now, as I said earlier, is an emphasis change. We, to be fair income and credible in the advice industry, need to build reputations based on knowledge, based on qualified people in the front line imparting really good knowledge to consumers. That's the main game. We know if we don't play that game, we're going to lose. The industry funds are playing that game. The IFAs are playing that game. So the banks absolutely have to play that game, and we will.
So if I went with my current circumstances to a bank planner, I went to, say, three or four bank planners to get advice, should that advice I get be exactly the same from each of them? Or would it be exactly the same?
It's interesting that you context that question by just comparing bank planners.
Any planner.
I think if you went into any planner and any different, it might be an IFA business. In fact, if you went into five different IFA businesses, you should probably ask the same question. The reality is, based on what I've seen, you don't always get exactly the same advice. The question of should you depends on the conversation that took place between the consumer and the advisor. So if you go to a doctor with a problem, do you get the same analysis with every doctor? I'll let you be the judge of that. Based on my personal experience, you don't. Now, should you? Probably. If the advisor or the doctor is asking all of the right questions and listening properly, then you should get somewhere around about the same strategic advice. It doesn't always happen because the level of chemistry built up between or rapport between the individual and the professional can sometimes be different. So it's just a human nature thing. Sometimes you're able to get all of the answers to the questions, sometimes you're not. So to wish for a perfect world, I think, is a little bit naive, but there should be some degree of consistency.
Yeah, but if we say it's a perfect world, it means, therefore, that financial planning is generic, and that then means you can automate it.
That's a different spin. I would say that for the baby boomers and the affluent pre-retirees, clearly there is a value placed on a face-to-face relationship. Yeah. And clearly that intangible peace of mind that is created through human interaction is really, really important. I think for a large number of Generation X's that is true as well. But as I was saying earlier on, we have to find a different way to serve the Generation X people. Mind you, at the heart of that, if you go back to my Justin Guitar analogy, the reason why I bought Justin Guitar's products at the end of the day was I liked him. Okay. And I enjoyed the interaction. So there's always going to be that human component.
Okay, thank you. Debbie, there's a question here about the active account size. So you, I think, said there was a median account size of about $10,000. So I'm assuming a lot of those, that was taken from an inactive and active. That's the active.
Am I switched on?
Yes. Yeah, I know, yeah.
It is across the fund, so it would include inactives, but we actually, as an industry fund, have quite a low inactive membership.
Right.
And that's, yeah, we have policies in place. We really try and engage with members, and we actually do IRF quite actively.
Yeah.
So it is more, you know, the inactive is not a, it is not a big player for us. The issue with us is younger members and obviously older members who have multiple accounts, and that's why the account balances are quite low.
Right. I suppose the taking up the point that Andrew said too is that there's a intergenerational charging question in your fund, so in, more so than in most other areas, I guess, where the younger members are being charged basically for the advice that older members get, which may be okay as long as they stay there the whole time, but it means you could be picked off. So how did the trustees look at that question?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that's actually why we've very much have structured any advice that is targeted specifically for the older group actually is paid for. And I need to be very specific. You know, if it's comprehensive advice, we actually, all of that is on a fee-for-service basis, and it actually covers the cost of advice. So there'll actually be a dollar charge that covers the comprehensive. It's just in our single-issue advice that we actually have some of that where there's no charge. But the only elements that there's no charge is making contributions, investment choice, or insurance.
Right.
And the reason we only do those three is exactly for that reason, because that's something that is for the whole membership of the fund. And in fact, we're giving most of our insurance advice is actually in the under 40s. So the areas that are for the 55 plus, which is transition to retirement, they do actually pay.
Right.
And we feel quite strongly about that we do operate on a user pays. But, you know, there are some aspects of the fund that are shared across the whole membership. For example, we have some members who are far more active in terms of contacting the call centre. And, you know, every time a member phones our call centre, there's a specific cost. And we have calculated what that cost is. Now, we don't charge those members that call. And we might have some members that call four or five times a year. And I think that the intra-fund, the true intra-fund space is much the same. We're actually happy to spread that across the fund.
Thank you. Question for starting off with you, Andrew, but then the others might be interested. We did a survey prior to the conference and asked a number of questions. One of the questions was about the best interest test and if that's workable. And 60% people said yes, they think the best interest test is a workable. I suppose that means 40% didn't, but 60% do. And you pointed to it, I think, has actually got some fundamental, I mean, it's a very important development. Having a best interest test. So do you think it's a workable test? And I'll ask the other two to respond in a minute.
I think it's unbelievably important. I mean, the industry in the main has strongly supported best interest because if you actually have a best interest obligation properly articulated, properly codified in the Corps Act, that removes a lot of the uncertainty which has existed in the past. So the industry has actually generally supported that quite strongly. It was always the intention with best interest that it would cater for both, if you like, holistic and comprehensive advice, but also, you know, whether you call it scaled or scoped advice. So the issue at the moment is it's reasonably, it's well defined in section 961B, but you get to the end there and there's this catch-all thing which says, notwithstanding all the above, you need to consider all the client's circumstances, et cetera, in the finalisation of your advice. And that's where it brings in this degree of uncertainty. So the answer is it depends. ASIC is going to issue a guidance note in September, which hopefully will clarify that. And that will actually be incredibly important in terms of making it work, certainly for industry funds, in the banking model, It's important in the self-managed super fund sector. I didn't touch on it, but there's a lot of people in the SMSF sector who also just want single issue or scoped advice. It might be around investment. It might be around compliance issues. They don't want the whole shebang. If we're going to increase access to advice in the industry, getting the best interest thing finalised in a satisfactory way is really important.
Yeah, and do you have the same similar views, the other guys?
Yeah, I would have the same views. We think it is really, really critical. And, of course, you know, our environment is a little bit different because we have had some best interests in terms of the CIS requirements. But we think it's workable, but I agree with Andrew. It's the detail, and especially the detail around the scoped advice issue.
I mean, Andrew covered it pretty comprehensively. We certainly agree that a best interest test is a very good development for the industry. We should have it. I do worry, though, that litigant lawyers will be licking their lips about a principles-based holistic definition and a catch-all that is pretty much undefined. So it would be our preference to tighten it up, to define it a bit more, know exactly what the target is we're aiming at, to enable this to be applied in the right way. But absolutely agree, we have to have it.
Yeah. And do you think FOFA, there'll be more or less people using advisors as a result of FOFA?
I think there'll be more. I think the ways that clients will interact with advisors will change. So the holistic one-size-fits-all model of the past will no longer be the one-size-fits-model of the future. You'll have the online, phone, video conference, limited, you know, holistic and various, different sort of gauges of that. But I think there will be more advisors. By definition, if you get into the area of phone-based advice and scaled advice, you will be talking to a lot more people than you have been before, but having shorter, more pithy conversations about single issues. So the actual mix of advice will change a lot over the next 5 to 10 years. That doesn't mean holistic will die. I mean, holistic is still going to be a very important part of advice, but there'll be other sources.
Okay.
I'll just add to that, Barry. I agree with Paul's comments, so I won't duplicate that. The other big one is with accountants, where there's going to be the removal of the accountant exemption around self-managed super funds and the introduction of a streamlined licensing regime. That means there's a lot of accountants at the moment who are currently involved in SMSF services who aren't currently licensed, will actually come into the licensing regime, and there's a portion of those who will actually go the full hog and become fully licensed. So that's going to be quite a significant growth area in the future.
So can I say one thing? I'm not sure FOFA is the reason,
right,
by the way, that more people will engage advisors. I think the industry was heading in this direction anyway.
Yeah.
So I just want to make that point. Now, FOFA's fine-tuned a few things and maybe provided a catalyst for a couple of things, but I think the industry was already listening to consumers before FOFA came along.
Okay, we've got time for one question, a yes or no answer from you, Andrew. To what extent is the growth in SMS generated from tax-driven strategies? Yes or no?
I'm not in the dock, so no. The biggest driver is control, disillusion with investment returns. Tax is a consideration, but it's actually not the primary.
Right, okay, good. Thanks very much. I'd like to thank our three speakers. Thank you.